From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, child abuse and neglect in Texas, and TPR's investigative project, When Home is the Danger.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Texas Public Radio spent more than a year analyzing more than 1,200 deaths from abuse and neglect between 2018 and 2023. The project, funded by the Pulitzer Center, brings stories of children who died when the state failed to do enough to intervene. Accountability editor and reporter Paul Flav found a child welfare system so intent on reducing its contact with troubled families that children have routinely been left with violent, unstable, drug-abusing parents while authorities closed cases and walked away. A warning for listeners, this report does include graphic reporting about the deaths of children.
At some point, each of the 1,200 deaths of children from abuse and neglect in Texas resulted in a 911 call.
911,
on July 25th, 2022, it was 2-year-old Wyatt Pickett who took his last breath at his home in a trailer park 2 hours southwest of Houston.
Do you know what happened?
This is his father, Randall Pickett.
We went to the park, and he fell. We kept him up for a while. We all just laid down for a nap. We woke up, and he's not breathing.
But police say that wasn't true. Instead, they say Wyatt and his twin brother had been abused for months by his father, and then Wyatt fatally so by his father's girlfriend, Lorelei Crouch. The two are now in prison for murder and capital murder. But this tragedy didn't have to take place, says Wyatt's grandmother, Melissa Pickett.
It's a failure. The whole system is a failure. I can honestly say they could have done so many things differently. My grandson would still be alive.
The they she's talking about is the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, which is responsible for child abuse and neglect investigations and much of the child welfare system. Across Texas, kids died in terrible ways, like Susie Wilson's grandchild, Hardy Quinn, who died malnourished and beaten, despite numerous calls to the state.
First words out of my mouth is, oh my God, they've killed my baby.
Or Antonia Estrada's grandniece, Ronnie Salazar, who was dumped with strangers in San Antonio and died despite child welfare investigators warning that the girl should be removed.
The way they described it was they grabbed her head and rammed it into the wall so hard that it passed the chair on and hit the brick.
TPR's analysis found that more than half the 1,200 children who died from abuse and neglect had been in families or with caregivers that had previously been investigated by the child welfare system. 1 in 5 occurred in homes like Wyatt Pickett's that had been investigated 3 or more times. 200 of the deaths occurred also like Wyatt's, where an investigation took place within 6 months. What our investigation also showed was that in the last 4 years, legislators and agency heads embraced new laws and policies that reduced how many abused and neglected children were sheltered by the state, but also reduced the services designed to keep those children safe when they were left behind with troubled parents. Those services include mandatory drug testing, treatment, and domestic violence prevention efforts. In many ways, the state is closing cases, hoping for the best, and walking away.
What it feels like on the ground is that CPS is implementing policies that turn a blind eye to real issues in families.
That's co-director of the Children's Rights Clinic at the University of Texas Austin Law School, Lori Duke.
And instead of trying to fix the issues, they're trying to figure out a way to avoid even addressing them.
DFPS, despite reducing child protection efforts, says kids are still safe, pointing to a 60% reduction in child abuse neglect deaths between 2020 and 2024. But their numbers are highly questionable because the state redefined what constituted a neglect death, aggressively driving down two of the largest causes of child neglect deaths, drownings and smotherings caused by unsafe sleep arrangements. Let's take a deeper look at Wyatt's case. The 2-year-old's story touches on two policy and law changes that appear to have affected his life and his death. Wyatt's home had been investigated multiple times for methamphetamine abuse and domestic violence, At one point, his father allegedly put a knife to his mother's throat. But investigators on the case could not convince staff or DFPS attorneys to deliver services to the family to mitigate the risk or to remove the boy.
You know, I honestly think it was a time in the department where they didn't want to remove kids.
Daniel Beyer was one of those investigators.
They wanted reunification at all costs.
Beyer tried to get the family services. Wyatt and his brother could have been regularly checked by a social worker, inspected for bruises. Their father could have been required to get drug treatment. But the family was denied, like thousands of others, following a 2020 eligibility rule change that data indicates caused rejections to skyrocket.
They went up 721% in 1 year.
Wow.
That's a number I can't even believe. You said it was a humdinger. That's a humdinger. Not surprised, because I was still working within that. Remember the frustration we would feel? I mean, we felt it. We were the investigators. You know, we were doing our job, and then to be rejected, I remember those times. It was very frustrating.
When Beyer tried to get DFPS lawyers to go to court, they said it didn't meet the legal threshold, which had been raised in 2021.
Well, if you can't get a court order, can't remove, you close it.
So despite investigators telling DFPS lawyers Wyatt was in danger, because of policy changes and law changes, they had to close the case. Melinda Gushwa, a social work researcher and professor, says that is a bad strategy.
Those are the scary cases. We shouldn't be closing those cases.
That's why I retired. Because once again, it goes back to me feeling like I wasn't being effective anymore. It was becoming to be impossible.
The bill that raised the legal threshold for removals was called House Bill 567. It, among other things, redefined neglect. Now a caregiver had to show blatant disregard through their actions, and a child must be in immediate danger for the state to consider a removal. The change was intended to reduce unnecessary and traumatic removals. It passed with bipartisan support. Here's the author, North Texas Republican House member James Frank, speaking with TPR a year after the law passed.
And again, I'm not saying it's perfect in every case, but I think we have decreased the false and unnecessary removals, and we have made sure to allow that we can still remove those very dangerous cases.
That first year, removals dropped more than 40% for what's called neglectful supervision, a category of neglect that Frank said was often misused. But removals also dropped across the board, with physical abuse and medical neglect both seeing more than 20% drops the first year. Child welfare advocates, legislators, lawyers, and judges voiced concern over the law's impact.
This change in the standard to remove children, in my opinion, was a mistake.
State Senator Jose Menendez represents San Antonio.
So do you have to be present when someone's holding a hammer to someone or a weapon?
Hearing descriptions of child fatalities that followed, a dejected Menendez mused about the possible need to replace the entire department.
Sometimes when you hear stuff like this, you just wonder, should we just scrap the whole damn thing and start over? Fire everybody.
But for many conservative parents' rights groups and legislators, the drop in removal in and of itself was a huge victory.
It's so easy to look at data and see fewer kids being removed and just point to that in isolation as a good development.
Kathleen Lavalle runs Dallas CASA, a nonprofit that works directly with children in the child welfare system. She says the numbers the state is releasing on removals are misleading, because while removals dropped by half, the number of times families were found to have abused or neglected their kids did not drop as precipitously.
Because your mind instantly thinks there are fewer kids being abused. There are fewer kids being neglected. And that's obviously not the case.
As DFPS was reducing services and removals and remaking itself, other children well known to the system died. 10-year-old Jesse Pickle had autism, was nonverbal, and had mobility issues. But to his teachers at Bel Air Elementary in Athens, Texas, he was an affectionate and fun child who loved to ham it up for his classmates. They said he was a joy to be around and took to sign language.
He was almost always happy. He was always smiling and laughing.
But Riley Milligan, who taught him his final semester, says that smile went away at the end of the day because Jesse never wanted to go home.
He never wanted to get on the bus. There were some times when we would have to put him like in like a little wagon and like pull him out to the bus.
Jesse's home had been investigated 7 times in 6 years. His stepmother, Shauna Pickle, had been investigated a dozen times in as many years and had her own 4 biological children removed over abuse and neglect allegations years before. Again, Melinda Gushwa.
You don't put a child with someone who wasn't even capable of caring for their own kids, especially with this level of high need.
DFPS found reason to believe Shauna abused Jesse's sister, who was also developmentally delayed in 2016. But the department only found abuse the one time. Otherwise, it did not confirm what teachers said they were seeing. The children came to school intensely hungry, at times with bruises, and with full diapers that hadn't been changed in hours.
It was just really hard to continually tell CPS, like, this is what's happening, this is what's happening, and then just say, like, oh, it's fine. Or, oh, we investigated it. We can't remove them at this time. And, like, we don't see any reason to think that they were unsafe.
I would not have been able to sleep at night if those kids were on my caseload. I would just go to my supervisor and say, this is the hill we need to die on.
On the morning of December 27th, Jesse, who walked with crutches, dragged himself out of bed early, around 5 a.m. The boy had been vomiting for 2 days and had hardly eaten anything. He at times was vomiting blood. Shauna found him and put him back in his bed. Rather than take him to the hospital, his stepmother yelled profanities at him, according to the arrest affidavit, telling him to stay in bed. Shauna declined to speak with TPR for this story, citing her impending trial related to his death. The boy shook the bed, trying to get attention. He vomited up blood over the next several hours, going unchecked upon. The affidavit says Jesse used sign language to ask for water, but Shauna refused.
I mean, we taught him that. And he was, like, trying to communicate with her. And in his final moments, he was hoping that she, of all people, would help him. And she didn't.
Jesse died later that day from pneumonia. Doctors found blood in his lungs. The autopsy says dehydration played a contributing factor. While investigators in Jesse's case continued to find nothing to corroborate neglect, the damage being done to 3-year-old Alana Williams was well documented in images and x-rays. The state's half-hearted efforts failed to keep her safe. 6 years after his daughter died, Alana's father, Eddie Williams, still remembers a girl watching and singing songs from Moana.
Doc McStuffins, that was her thing also. She loved ice cream and popsicles, you know, she loved to start walks and then have me carry her the remainder. But again, it was just so much joy.
But one night in 2018, Eddie recalls his phone ringing at 3 a.m. Alana's mother, Brianna Brown, his estranged wife, told him the girl was gone and he should come to the Houston hospital where she passed away. When he got there, he was led to the cold room where her small body lay on a gurney.
All I could do was just hold her, you know. I had to come to that realization that this warm, loving, perfect example of unconditional love is actually dead and cold in my arms.
What he found out after her death is that DFPS never told him about the multiple hospital visits his daughter had in the last months of her life, and the multiple calls from medical staff about possible abuse, most notably dealing with a broken wrist. Williams says Brown was restricting his access to the girl and was keeping him in the dark, but so was the department. Alana's mother signed a safety plan with DFPS, saying she and her boyfriend Josh Sargent would not have unmonitored contact with her. But a safety plan is not legally binding, says Lori Duke.
They have no teeth. It's the honor system, right?
Brown and Sargent broke the safety plan, continuing to care for Alana at night. DFPS said Alana died after Brown and Sargent failed to seek medical attention promptly after she stopped breathing. She had nearly a liter of blood in her abdomen and showed signs of physical and sexual abuse.
I believe they dropped the ball.
Alana's grandmother, Mykeisha Vaughn, says she called DFPS several times and no one listened to her.
You had a grandmother presenting you evidence, not hearsay, not my feelings or my emotions. I mean pictures, facts, statements.
The girl was one of more than 2 dozen children TPR found who died while on open safety plans. and one of more than 70 who had been on a safety plan within a year of their death. Brown and Sargent were arrested. They both pled guilty to injury to a child. I'm Paul Flav, and this is a special edition of Texas Matters about child abuse and neglect deaths in the state called When Home is the Danger. An analysis by TPR of 1,200 child abuse and neglect deaths between 2018 and 2023 finds that the state of Texas is routinely leaving children in dangerous homes. We now travel to one family's tragedy in north central Texas. The story begs the question, how can a child's family reported to the state be considered safe if an investigator for DFPS never enters the home?
This is the first time I made the trip by myself. Usually somebody's with me, but I figured I'd brave it.
Every few weeks, Susie Wilson drives the 90 minutes south from Abilene to the tiny speck of a place called Trickum, a ghost of a town where the population last registered as 12.
Ugh, they need to cut the grass out here.
There's no post office or street lights. It boasts simply a highway, a church, and this cemetery.
She's right there, the one with all the little thingies on it.
The 69-year-old bends down to clean a headstone flush with the earth.
Hi, baby. This is Hardy.
This is where Wilson's granddaughter, Hardy Quinn Hill, was buried after the 9-year-old died, emaciated and bruised from abuse and neglect. For the past 2 years, Wilson and others have been trying to move the girl's body closer to her family because of the distance and because of the people who buried her here.
The last name that shows is Anderson. That is not her last name. She was never adopted. She was never anything.
She swings her arm, pointing to the plots next to Hardy's.
Anderson was this family name, which is the family of one of her two murderers.
Wilson's daughter, 49-year-old Dawn Hill Flesner, and her girlfriend, 44-year-old Jamie Anderson, pleaded guilty to the capital murder of the child in 2023. After being reported for concerns about the state of their home, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services initially gave the family what's called an alternative response. This included Hardy among more than 24 families who received that intervention within 2 years of a child's death. Alternative responses are less intensive contacts with DFPS. DFPS evaluates families and makes service referrals, but does not make an abuse or neglect determination. By contrast, an investigation can include interviews with teachers, doctors, home visits, and drug testing. Many parents, defense attorneys like Lindsay Dion, like the less intrusive methods.
When they call and they want to talk to one of my clients, I ask them, is this an alternative response case? Because what that tells me is they don't care and they're not going to do anything to my clients.
Wilson says Hardy Quinn's mother changed when she moved out of her house with the kids and into her girlfriend's in Brownwood, more than an hour away. Her daughter isolated herself and the children from the rest of the family, eventually cutting ties. Wilson says her daughter's girlfriend, Anderson, was very controlling. Someone reported the family to DFPS, saying their home had no water, toilet, central heat, stove, or refrigerator.
That's a scary report.
Dion, who began her career working for DFPS, says these allegations were too severe for an alternative response.
They did not do their job here, and this is a serious call. It blows my mind.
Dion says DFPS is using alternative response to quickly close cases. DFPS said in a statement that child safety is paramount and that these responses are evaluated under strict standardized criteria.
You know, like that has just become a dumping ground.
University of Michigan law professor Frank Vandervoort says, though, alternative response has been misused across the country.
And it's a way to manipulate the statistics so that nobody really knows how severe the problems are.
And the use of alternative response instead of more serious investigations of abuse and neglect in Texas grew by 50% between 2018 and 2023.
I think you should be worried about it.
Groups like Texans Care for Children, a child policy advocacy organization, have found positive outcomes from alternative response. In 2022, it found 90% of the cases were resolved without further needs. Regardless, though, even when Hardy's case was escalated to a traditional investigation the next year, the system continued to fail her. In the summer of 2021, an investigation was launched into the family. Tim Corley walks past a bright yellow backhoe on Avenue C in Brownwood, where the house at 700 C once stood.
We're on Avenue C, and you know, we're walking toward a house. A little girl died in that house to start with.
Now all that's left is an empty lot. Corley called the FPS twice, once because he suspected the family, who had no plumbing, was dumping their feces at the dumpster next to his house. After seeing the children near the dumpster, he went to ask one day, when he knocked.
Well, when they opened the door, it smelled so bad, like feces was rubbed on the walls. We had outhouses, I've been around. I know what shit smells like, but something I had never experienced before in my life. The strength of it.
DFPS told him the family was fine, but he says he doesn't think they did their jobs.
I don't think they did. I think that girl would be alive if they hadn't done it. When I saw, I don't see how anybody could miss it.
A few weeks after Corley called DFPS, sheriffs in nearby Coleman County did also. Hardy Quinn's mother had abandoned the girl at midnight in the cemetery in Trickham, the cemetery where she's now buried. It was not the first time, Wilson says. What was different about this time is that rather than sit terrified waiting for her mother to come back to this rural patch of land set amongst farmland, the girl started walking. Wilson retraces the route her granddaughter would have taken.
And at the time, this road was not cliched like this. It was just like that one back there, just dirt.
But then 8-year-old walked about a half mile in pitch black darkness, looking for help.
And from what I understand, I'm not quite sure if it was this house.
As Wilson sits outside one house in a car, Vicky Rice comes out. She tells her she's the one that found her granddaughter that night. The girl was very dirty and very hungry.
She ate everything that we had. We had made her a sandwich and she ate it and said she was still hungry, and we made her hot dogs and she ate those, and she drank milk, about 3 glasses of milk. But she said she was hungry. And we fed her.
I appreciate what you did for her.
I can't imagine.
The department wouldn't send someone out to Rice's house that night. The Coleman County Sheriff's pushed to prosecute Hardy Quinn's mother for child abandonment. But before the case had even been adjudicated, the department had already closed its case and walked away, offering no services or monitoring, despite finding Hill Flesner had neglectfully supervised her daughter. And still, no one pushed to go into the house.
Nobody went into that house until that child passed away. Why didn't they walk through the front door before? They didn't do their job, and I don't care how many times they want to say they did. They did not do their job.
DFPS declined to comment on this case, citing confidentiality. What police found when they did enter the home was one filled with human and animal feces. Trash and urine covered the mattress that Hardy and her brother shared. Locks were on food cabinets. While upstairs, where the adults lived, a clean and air-conditioned room, like a different home, one investigator wrote. 2 years after her granddaughter died, Wilson stands over a freshly dug grave. A small bulldozer has just finished its work at this cemetery outside Abilene. Her hand rests gently on the white 3/4-sized coffin.
So tiny. Really, I'm so sorry. It took so long.
Then she turns around and faces a group of family members who showed up on this weekday morning to reinter the child at a different cemetery away from the memory of her abuse. Sarah Flesner, who helped raise the girl, walks over to Wilson.
Thank you for getting her home.
You're welcome.
The two women embrace and cry. This is When Home is the Danger on Texas Matters. I'm Paul Flav. When TPR first started looking at this issue, there were two big questions. The first was, are deaths from child abuse and neglect in Texas really going down when nationally they're going up?
We've seen child deaths increase, you know, sort of creep up.
Frank Vandevort is a professor of practice at the University of Michigan School of Law.
And so, you know, agencies don't want that made public. Political leaders don't want that made public.
In Texas, the numbers had been growing for years. In 2018, it was 211 deaths. Then it was 235. Then it was more than 250 in 2020. Then it dropped. Fast. So how is it possible that the state's own data shows they are removing less children from homes and cutting the services to families to keep those kids safe in those homes? But the number of children they say are dying from abuse and neglect is dropping. It didn't make sense to me, or to others like Melinda Gushwa.
That does not feel right. It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't look right.
Then I saw it in a federal report on maltreatment. The same law that changed the definition of neglect in Texas was driving down the number of deaths counted as neglect. Two of the largest categories of child neglect deaths, drownings and unsafe sleep, dropped more than 35%. Emily Douglas is a professor at Montclair State University.
You're not decreasing the number of deaths. The overall death rate remains the same.
So I had my answer, sort of. But looking at the state's data around deaths investigated for abuse and neglect, I saw that between 2022 and 2023, the number dropped more than 30%. It turns out that after changing what counts as a neglect death, the state then decided to change when it even sent an investigator to find out if a child died by abuse or neglect. Now a department investigator only goes out if explicit concern is expressed by a first responder. So in some ways, Lori Duke says, it doesn't seem like the state is as diligent in looking for these kinds of deaths.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like.
The second big question I had was, how do you even tell these stories when so much of the data is anonymized? A federal law called the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act insists on a lot of privacy in investigations.
And why it's, you know, sort of opaque and hard to penetrate and understand what's actually going on.
Frank Vandervoort says states often use this as an opportunity to shield themselves from accountability.
Basically to hide poor practice, sort of protect itself from criticism and that kind of thing.
Even with things that the state was required to give freely to TPR, it dragged its feet. It took 6 months and legal threats to get it to release more than 1,000 fatality reports. When it finally did turn them over to TPR, the reports were peppered with mistakes. Misspelled names of victims, wrong or unlisted counties of residence, and sometimes misleading information. When 7-month-old Julian Macias passed away from methamphetamine exposure in Bexar County, DFPS's fatality report made no mention of his mother's extensive history with the department. According to a Bexar County Children's Court document obtained by TPR, Macias' mother had been an alleged perpetrator of abuse and neglect no less than 6 times in a DFPS investigation. Despite these many interactions with DFPS, a reader of the official fatality report would think there was no history, that the death was unforeseeable, that the state could not have provided services or oversight to prevent it. Laura Prather is a free speech attorney for Haynes & Boone.
Which is a huge problem from a societal perspective.
High costs bar TPR from getting other documents. When we requested 5 years' worth of data on removal requests that were denied and a child subsequently died, the state sent a labor estimate of 18 months, which would have meant a cost of $225,000. Again, Laura Prather.
That sounds highly suspicious. It sounds like there's likely a spreadsheet somewhere.
Ultimately, the costs were too high, but TPR persisted in other ways to show how policy and legal changes were affecting child safety. The result was the project When Home is the Danger. You can find more data and stories at whenhomeisthedanger.org. I'm Paul Flav. Thanks for listening.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.